call our second case, please. The court will now call in the interest of W.M.R. Tyler. Mr. David Mullane, the Auburn City Attorney. Mr. Eric Jensen, the taxpayer, the Auburn City Attorney. Thank you. You may proceed.
Thank you.
May it please the court, my name is David Moraine, and I'm here on behalf of the appellant, Mr. Remus. This case has called to the court's attention several appellate issues, all of which are important to the case, but some of which are important to the jurisdiction, to the jurisprudence of this state as it affects family law cases and the way that those cases are going to be reviewed on appeal following the rendition of judgments in the trial court. I've broken down my argument into subsections that I will address some of the points that we brought up in our brief one at a time. The first issue that I want to talk about is child support past the age of 18. This case started off with a 2000 agreed final decree of divorce. The child support provisions in that final decree of divorce were modified in 2001 by virtue of an agreed order. Now, it's important that that order did not contain any findings that are required by the family code to establish a support obligation for a disabled child past that child's 18th birthday. In fact, neither the 2000 final decree of divorce nor the 2001 order contain those findings that were required by the family code. In that case, the parties worked under the 2001 order for some almost 10 years. 10 years later, Mrs. Remus came back and had her interpretation of that order and filed a motion to enforce the order seeking the enforcement of child support provisions past the child's 18th birthday. We don't believe that because years ago, 18 years ago or so, this court in Claver versus Claver held that if an order does not have provisions in it extending the court's jurisdiction past the child's 18th birthday, in other words, if the court doesn't find the child's disabled so the child support continues past the 18th birthday, child support automatically terminates when the child turns 18 and the court's jurisdiction over the parties to order support to be paid terminates at that time. We think that that's exactly what happened in this case. Like I say, neither the 2000 order contained all of the requirements required to impose child support past the 18th birthday for a disabled child. Neither did the 2001 order. In fact, the few findings that were made in the 2000 order were expressly removed in the 2001 order. Now, if I understand Mrs. Remus's argument on appeal correctly in relation to this particular issue, she argues that because the parties modified the language in the health insurance portion of the 2001 order, providing that my client, Mr. Remus, would provide health insurance for life, that that modification should carry over and also extend to the child support provisions in that order. We don't... Well, and I think that's our point, is that the 2001 was an agreed order. It's interpreted according to contract principles. The 2001 order, the parties specifically changed...
Part of your argument, you say it's not interpreted according to contract principles. When it benefits them, you say it's not interpreted according to contract principles because that language wasn't included in the order, but when it benefits you, you say it does.
Well, and I think that's a good point, and that's one that I wanted to address today. One of the reasons that we've structured our brief the way that we have is because Mrs. Remus throughout this case has taken some conflicting positions in regards to the orders and what they mean and how they're to be interpreted. For instance, in page 68 of the clerk's record, you'll find a trial brief that Ms. Remus filed with the court stating that the 2001 order is ambiguous and must be interpreted as an ambiguous contract. Well, when we get to her brief on appeal, she's arguing that no, absolutely, the 2001 order is not ambiguous and it's not subject to interpretation. So what we had to do in writing our brief to the court is anticipate both sides of the arguments and show the court how Mr. Remus prevails on both sides. That's why in our brief we have, you know, if the order is not ambiguous, this is why Mr. Remus wins. If the order is ambiguous, this is why Mr. Remus wins, because, like I say, Mrs. Remus has taken conflicting positions throughout this case on the legal issues that were presented at the case. You know, I referred the court a minute ago to the trial brief that she filed. Just a couple of weeks later, at a hearing on entering a judgment, they argued to the court, it's in the reporter's record, they argued to the court that although they just filed this trial brief saying this was an ambiguous order, they're in front of the court arguing, no, this order is not ambiguous and it's not subject to interpretation. The court did not make a finding of ambiguity. The court did not enter a clarification order. The court made several findings, but none of those findings pertained to ambiguity or clarification of the 2001 order. But that is probably why it appears that our brief goes two different ways at once. It's because we're trying to cover each base based on what theory we thought Ms. Remus may advance on appeal. Okay, so I guess my point is the parties in 2001 would not have had to change the provision in relation to the health insurance that they changed. The prior language in that order said, prior language, I mean the typewritten language in the order, had said that he'll pay for health insurance as long as child support's payable. Well, on the day of the hearing, the parties appeared, and you'll see in the order, they crossed that out. And they crossed out the language that says as long as child support is payable, and they changed it to for Matthew's life. They wouldn't have had to go through that provision if they had intended the other child support provisions or if the other child support provisions were there for life. They had to do that because they recognized the child support provisions were one thing, the health insurance provisions were something quite differently. And so if they were going to agree to pay health insurance for life, which Mr. Remus did agree to and has, they would need to make that change, which is exactly what's reflected in that order. Well, and I agree with you. I mean, I think that reduction below zero is what terminates the child support obligation, because if you don't have an obligation to pay for anything, then I think that that terminates that obligation.
Then why didn't you say terminate? Because it shall be reduced by.
I was not the lawyer in 2001, and I don't know why that says that, nor do I know why the court entered the order as it did. But if you reduce something, if you reduce a payment obligation below zero, that has the effect of terminating the payment obligation. And as a matter of law, the child support obligation in the absence of a finding required by Section 154, we've cited this court to a number of cases which hold that as a matter of law, regardless of what the order says, if there's not a finding in there that says this is a disabled child that requires substantial care and personal supervision, that order terminates as a matter of law on the child's 18th birthday. So
the language in the original decree is not sufficient because it just said that he was a disabled child.
What it said was, and I'll paraphrase it, but it basically said that he suffers from a condition, and in the future he will be incapable of self-support. There is no finding that he requires substantial care and personal supervision, which are the findings that are required by 154.
The original decree says the court finds that William Matthew Remus suffers from muscular dystrophy and will be incapable of being self-supporting after the age of 18.
Yes.
So that's my question. Why didn't that carry forward to the next order? All the agreed order did was talk about payments and child support. Why is that provision not in effect just like all the other provisions of the divorce decree that weren't modified?
That's a two-part question. And first of all, the language that was in the 2000 court order, I think, is insufficient. I don't think that a partial...
Are you talking about the decree or the 2001?
The 2000 decree. And for clarity, I'll try to refer to them as decree and order.
Okay.
The language in the decree, the findings that were made in the decree, I don't believe were sufficient. I think it was sufficient to establish that the cause of a disability was known prior to the child's 18th birthday. Which is one of the prongs that would have to be established under the Family Code to qualify for extended support under Chapter 154. But you would also need to have separate findings that he requires substantial care and personal supervision. And there was no findings of that in that decree. So I don't think that the findings in the 2000 divorce decree were sufficient to provide for support for an adult disabled child. Now, whether or not those findings from the 2000 decree carried forward into the 2001 decree is almost a red herring, because those findings were insufficient. They didn't get you there. So whether they carried forward or not is kind of a non-issue, but we don't believe that they did. And the reason that we don't believe that they did was because these parties met and they substantially rewrote all of the provisions relating to child support. And the duration of child support, and how it was going to be paid, and how it was going to be calculated, and when it was going to be due. And I think when they do that kind, the whole section of the decree that pertains to child support is what was modified in that 2001 order. Well, I think where I'm looking at is on page 1 of the 2001 order, and there's a provision that talks about child support obligations, and then it lists those child support obligations, does exactly what you're talking about, where it reduces below zero. There's a wage withholding provision. There's the additional child support provision, which we'll get to in a moment. They redid the health insurance section. It seems... when you go up to the section above children, the court finds that the following child is. The court makes the findings about the child, but again, there is nothing in this order that pertains to the child's disability in 2001. Again, largely I think that issue doesn't particularly matter, because in 2000 I don't think the findings were sufficient to confer that extended jurisdiction on the court, because there was... Well, certainly, I don't know that you remanded and have the court clarify, at least on this particular issue. I think that the relief should be that there is no child support obligation after the age of 18. Now, that's narrow relief, and there's a narrow window in there, because when Matt turned 20, his mother did come back and file a motion to modify a current order. We think it should have been a petition to establish support for an adult disabled child. Nevertheless, the issues would have been the same, and that's going to be the order that we talk about in just a minute, which is the one that was rendered in 2011. Which, by the way, also, I suppose we can talk about it right now, that order also did not make the findings required by Section 154. In fact, it didn't even attempt to make those findings, which will lead us to our point about findings. Mrs. Remus argues that when findings are required but findings are not made, that they are in fact implied as a matter of law. that this court is to imply all findings necessary to support the trial court's judgment. That is true unless the trial court includes findings in its judgment. We've cited the court to six or seven cases that have so held that when the court includes partial findings in its judgment, the appellate court cannot imply additional findings necessary to support the judgment that don't appear from the four corners of the judgment. We've had, I know as of last month, there was two or three family law cases that applied this rule to. One of them was out of the first district in Houston. There's another one out of the 14th district in Houston, where they are applying this rule, certainly in CPS cases and in other custody and support cases. But the bottom line is the rule is once the trial court undertakes to make findings, which the trial court did in this case, the judgment has to be reviewed for sufficiency based on the findings that were made in the trial court. Because that judgment did not include findings, it's not sufficient to support a child support obligation past age 18.
May it please the court. I am Eric Dankesrider, and I'm on here on behalf of the appellee, Judy Remus. And I'd like to address the appellate issues in kind of the order that we grouped them in our appellate brief. We've grouped some of the appellant's issues together. We think that the issues that they raise in 1, 2, 3, and 7 are all deal with this continuing jurisdiction issue. Some of the questions that come from the court are very pertinent there. We think that we don't think you have to try the same issue over and over again every time this comes back before the court. And that's basically what counsel argues, is that every time you come back to the court on an order, seeking an order for an adult disabled person, that you'd have to have another trial and get another finding from the court consistent with the order that we had in 2000 in this case. That was never an issue in the case. We didn't try whether or not Matthew was disabled, because there was already a finding out of the court that he was disabled, and it was just simply undisputed that the court had jurisdiction because of that initial finding. Your Honor, I don't believe that I believe that it does have sufficient language to indicate to the trial court and to the appellate court that all of those findings are there. There's no law that counsel cited in his briefing that says that the order has to have that specific language in the decree or in an order making those specific findings. That's just didn't fall. The decree didn't just track that language out of the family code, but you can see from this finding there would have been no purpose back in 2000 when Matthew was age 9 to make a finding that he had muscular dystrophy and that he would be incapable of being self-supporting. At age 9, they made that ruling. That was the finding. That was the purpose for it, because the order then goes on, both in that order and then in 2001, to say that his support goes on for his lifetime. And so both of those orders are consistent with that ruling. That was obviously the intent of the court. Otherwise, you wouldn't have this language that wasn't standard that says the support goes on for his lifetime or until his death. So I think that language was purposely put in there to make that finding. As the court pointed out, the decree back in 2000 makes that finding, and then the order says that he's going to that Mr. Remus has to pay for the rest of Matthew's lifetime. Counsel cites a couple cases that he says basically whenever you have a new order that supersedes the other order and it entirely takes out any rulings in the prior order and any findings in the prior order. But his cases that he cites too, this Ramsey versus Ramsey and Aguilera, don't say that at all. Those cases don't say that an order takes those things out. In fact, the order that we have clearly in and of itself says it's modified. Doesn't say that it supersedes the previous order. And again, the order was consistent with that language of the original divorce decree in 2000. there's no express language. Once the court has jurisdiction, there's been and made a finding that Matthew was disabled. There's no express finding in any of the subsequent orders, either in 2001 or 2011, that Matthew's condition had improved. And we think that that would have been required, that they would have had to have a finding that his condition had changed from that prior ruling or from that prior finding in order to change jurisdiction. And in fact, the reason that that was never brought up, because that was never alleged that Matthew had improved or anything about that, because it was just taken for granted that that finding was already in place. Sure. Your Honor, we believe that the evidence that supports the rearage are Exhibits 1 through 18, and then the reporter's record, I think 1 through 18, 19, and then a lot of the testimony of the parties regarding what the income of the parties were. If you look at the early, and then we have the summary that was admitted as a summary of the testimony or the summary of the relief. I understand. Here's what they tell us. One of the arguments that we've made here is that the court is just a scrivener can do a calculation. Our argument was on the early years on those numbers that the court could determine, if you looked at what his child support that he was paying based upon those early years, that was 20% of his net income. You could back that out of his income, and then you could determine, based upon what his testimony was, that his salary was, you could determine that the rest was commission. And it was just a mathematical calculation that was done that we explained to the court, and the court did that calculation.
His salary continued the same over the course of time, so the rest of it must be commission?
No, Your Honor, Justice, his salary changed, but we had evidence in the record from his testimony of what his salary was, what his base salary was. And then on top of that base salary, he received the additional income that we have the dispute whether that's commission or bonus, and we believe it all fell within the term bonus. We believe that one of the issues on the bonus versus commission issue is really that the term was never clarified. There was not a clarification order. The term was not ambiguous. We prepared a brief regarding ambiguous, but the court made no finding that the terms were ambiguous. In fact, what the court did was just simply determine, as trial courts do, that this income fit within these terms in the order. And Mr. Remus, he wanted to say that everything was a commission, so therefore he didn't have to pay any child support based upon it. And our argument was that that the income that he received on top of his salary actually fit into that definition of, or into a definition of bonus.
Well, it's two sides of the same coin. You want to say it's all commission, and you want to say it's all bonus. But those are two different words with two different meanings in the financial world, aren't they?
Well, depending on what they mean, Judge, and that was our argument at the trial. A lot of times whenever you have, if we didn't have evidence here that Mr. Remus had received, his salary was based upon a commission, based upon some kind of structure where he got a percentage of the sales, like a commission. His was actually under the terms that he used as he described it. His definition of it could be a definition for bonus. Basically, he received an income on top of his salary based upon how well he did and how well the company did.
Appears to me to be a pre-printed
business pay stub. It says commission earned. It doesn't say anything about
right. No, it doesn't, Judge. There's only one pay stub that for the $500 that says bonus, which he didn't pay in child support based on that either. But it doesn't say bonus there. It says COMM or commission. We can assume that that's what it meant. But the employer doesn't get to define what it is, because if we look at in the original, like in a normal decree stage, when somebody would come to the court and say, this is reimbursement for use of my vehicle, the court can say that's income and put it into income. It's not reimbursement, it's actual income that then can be treated for the purposes of determining child support. The court makes that determination, not the employer, and certainly not the employee. The court has to determine whether it fits within that that term that the court's ordered. And here, there was a lot of discussion at trial about what the term bonus meant. There was discussion about what they called it, the parties called the bonus, or what the extra income that he received, what they called it. They always called it a bonus.
But
that was the testimony.
Well,
the testimony came in, Your Honor, without objection. So the testimony did come in before for the court to consider.
But legally, it's only relevant.
Well, there was no objection to relevance. And then the other thing is, the court can simply, and the court I think did just look at what the description is of those, what he said he received the monies for. And he described why he received the monies, and the court could have said, I believe that's a bonus. The court did that. What counsel wants to do, what the appellate wants the appellate court to do, is simply replace the trial court's judgment with its own and say, we'll look at Black's Law Dictionary, or we'll decide what in the financial world these two terms have different meanings. That I don't think the appellate court should do. The trial court had evidence before it. Had the parties testify, the court could disregard one or the other and make the determination whether this income fit within this order.
Yeah, but this isn't a situation where the facial expressions, the demeanor, the tone of voice, all those things that the trier of fact looks at and determines the credibility of the witness comes into play here. This is, I think, as a matter of law, is this money a commission or is this money a bonus? And does the wording of the family code encompass both, or only encompass one of these?
Well, I disagree to the extent that there is no black letter law that says this is a commission and this is a bonus. We don't have that law, and counsel didn't cite for you any such law. He did cite for you some Black's dictionary definitions, and even under the definition he chose, I think you could. Of course, he left out the other definitions whenever he cited to it that we then gave to the court. Under those definitions, the reason that Mr. Remus received this income could fall within that definition, even under Black's Law Dictionary.
And it also has been very easy to use the term commission, bonus, or other income, and we wouldn't be having this argument, right?
You could have been in the original order, and we wouldn't be having this argument. But since the parties, and that I think that goes back to the reason why it was there, the parties had always called this extra income a bonus, and that's why they put it in the decree in that way, in the agreed decree, because that's how that's what the term that they used. No, I don't believe that's the case. I believe that he'd received commissions prior to that time.
But if you look at the original divorce decree, it awards child support. It says earnings means compensation paid or payable to Michael Remus for personal services, whether called wages, salary, commission, bonus, or otherwise, and includes periodic payments pursuant to pension, disability, retirement program, and unemployment benefits. So if that amount included commission and bonus, and that's the amount that's reduced, then how can we include bonus and commission again?
Because in the subsequent order, you're talking about the original decree. In the subsequent order in 2001, what they did was they pulled out the commission and did it based upon a 20. They pulled it out and did it based upon a 20%, and the rest of it was done based upon the 800 and whatever dollars. They pulled. They used the term bonus. Yes, Your Honor.
So if all those were included in the original decree, and all they pulled out was bonus, then isn't it only supposed to assume that they meant what they said?
Well, I think that they did mean what they said, and I think that the monies that Mr. Remus received, and I think that that's what the court found, was the monies that Mr. Remus received were bonus. Doesn't matter what he called them, doesn't matter what his employer called them, doesn't matter what Mrs. Remus called them. The fact is that what he received was bonus under that order, and that was what the trial court found, and that's why she awarded a judgment based upon those amounts. I mean, that's why we're not arguing about the definition, because the court just simply found that those monies that he received, for the reasons that he received it, that was testified to at trial, the reasons that he received it, that money fell within the term bonus.
Well, didn't we look at the decree to determine whether there's a difference between a bonus and a commission? And apparently there was, because they used both words.
Well, I don't think you look at the decree to determine what the modification order meant by bonus. In neither the decree or in the modification order are those terms defined. And if you look at, they could have meant the same thing, they could have meant something different, because they're not defined. And if the court, one of the cases that we cite to the court is a Supreme Court case in 2005, where the Supreme Court used those terms interchangeably. And so that's our argument, is those terms, we're just simply saying that money fell within that definition, or in that term. Thank you.
I know I've only got 5 minutes, so I want to hit a couple of points in rebuttal. One, Ms. Remus has argued that the court's not to use or look at or improper to look at dictionary definitions. However, I think the law is that when there are undefined terms in an agreement, the court is specifically directed to use dictionary definitions. That's the Dynegy case, 305 SW3D 309. In Ms. Remus's brief, she raises the issue. One of our appellate points is complaining about the discretionary nature of the order in relation to the purchase of the van and other supplies, that is not bounded by reasonableness, is what we think the court is required to do. We cite the case of Matter of Marriage versus Thurmond, and that is 888 SW2D 269. Ms. Remus has argued that case actually supports her position that reasonableness is not required. I'll just read to you the holding of that case briefly. It says that orders that do not set dollar limits, such instances do not permit the imposition of vague and indefinite obligations or obligations left to the unbridled discretion of the other party. If there is no dollar limit set, like there's not here, there must be some objective standard by which the obligation may be measured. The court goes on to explain that that's meant by imposing a reasonableness standard, which is precisely our complaint on appeal. Yeah, in this instance, that's right. What has happened is, but the court has given Mrs. Remus the unilateral ability to go out and incur an expense. Whether it be, she could buy a $2 million Rolls-Royce van. I'm not saying she would do that. But then my client, under penalty of going to jail, would be obligated to pay for that. And we think that the court has to impose a reasonableness requirement for those types of expenses. I don't believe so. It's an interesting issue that hasn't really been treated in case law that I've been able to find, except when we go back and we look at the health insurance provision cases. And, you know, for health insurance expenses and for health care expenses, those have to be reasonable. We define those as being reasonable as being 10% of what income, what person's income is. That's presumptive reasonableness. Obviously, that definition of reasonableness would vary based on the incomes of the two parties. So I don't know that making the parties split that expense, so to speak, operates as the type of objective safeguard that could then be objectively reviewed by a court later, which is, I think, the safeguard that was intended in the Thurman decision and any other decision that we cited the court to. Next issue, statute of limitations. We think that the appellate court determines the applicable limitations period as a matter of law. Once the issue's been raised in the trial court, whether it's a 2-year, 10-year, or 4-year statute of limitations, we think you look at that and determine that as a matter of law, and that's what we've asked you to do in this case. I think our other points we've addressed in our reply brief. I did want to talk about bonus versus commission, but I understand I'm almost out of time. I will say that what Mrs. Remus calls commission or bonus, I think Justice Gabriel is exactly right. That's irrelevant until somebody makes an allegation or a determination that the underlying agreement was ambiguous. And both sides in this case have asked the court to determine the merits of the case based on what the 2001 order says. Thank you.
We appreciate your arguments here today. The court will just be in a brief recess to allow counsel in the case of David Cantor et al. Versus Chesapeake Energy to take their places at counsel table, and then we will reconvene.